Hello and welcome to the Scholars Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what dictators, CEOs, and other political leaders have in common. We'll explore some of their strategies for getting and keeping power. But first, we're joined by Jennifer Witten Woodring, professor at University of Massachusetts at Lowell and Douglas Van Bell, senior lecturer at Victoria University, and their book is called The Historical Guide to World Media Freedom. Welcome to the Scholars Circle. It's great to have the two of you. Media freedom and its effects. So I wonder, maybe we should start right there. As you both state in your introduction of your book on this subject, media freedom is thought to be connected to all kinds of important things, good government, democratization, human rights. So maybe we should start by defining what is media freedom? How do you know when it's there? Jennifer Witten Woodring, how would you define it? How do you measure it?
Actually, Doug was the one who started this project and came up with the definition that we use, so I want to give him credit for that. Basically, we define media freedom as an environment in which journalists are able to report critically about government behavior, about issues that are very important, issues that if the people were to become aware of them, for example, they might push for a change in leader if they didn't like what the leader did. Thinking along the lines of Watergate, for example.
Doug Van Bell, what would you add to that?
The definition is a little bit stolen from Robert Entman, where he talked about freedom as the ability to complain. And that's kind of the theme we carried through, was that can you complain about a government official? Can you complain about government? That was really sort of the thing you would look for when deciding whether you had press freedom or not.
And so when you go through and you went country by country by country and said what degree of media freedom each of these countries has, I mean, how do you measure that? Doug Van Bell, how did you guys come up with these essentially, you know, quantifications of how free a country is?
It's surprisingly simple in terms of seeing it, because what you find is that very few countries spend very little time in sort of a halfway or nearly free kind of situation. They very either quickly sort of settle in at on the free side, or they very quickly settle in on the sort of authoritarian control side. And usually states in transition that are somewhere in between. So usually they're quite clearly on one side or the other. You can see it through the coverage. You can see it through the reports on reporter harassment and that sort of thing.
Well, give us some examples so that we can get a sense of this.
Well, Mexico, for a long time, was the only country that was sort of halfway in between. So usually you take your traditional Western states, your United States, your Australia, Canada, those sorts of things. They're going to have different small issues in terms of differences in the nature of press freedom. You're going to have some that are going to have a little more problem with government interference. You're going to have some that have a little more problem with this, that, or the other thing. But on a functional level, they function the same. People can complain. People can protest and get their voices heard. And then as soon as you cross that line, you very quickly go to prison sentences for protesting. So, for instance, Turkey. Turkey has very quickly crossed that line well into the side where you really can't do some of these things anymore.
And Jennifer Witten Woodring, what would you add to this?
Well, I think Mexico is a really interesting example because for years, as a one-party state, firmly under the control of the PRI, Mexico was, by just about anyone's estimation, not a democracy, and yet the media in Mexico were functionally free. That doesn't mean, by the way, that they actually did engage in a lot of criticism of government, but the potential to do so was there. And then what happened in Mexico, as Mexico democratized, there were all these problems with the cartels and so much upheaval that the media environment became not free. So Mexico is one of those really interesting cases, because we would expect to see most democracies with media freedom and most non-democracies without it. And yet what Doug and I have found is that that's normally the case. Most media freedom exists in democracies, and most absence of media freedom or controlled media exists in non-democracies. But there are exceptions, and they're very interesting to look at.
It's interesting you'd mentioned Mexico as being this example. And it seems like, from what I've read on Mexico, and they called it the perfect dictatorship before when it was under the control of the PRI, but it seemed like there was a window in which media were free. And then you mentioned the cartels. So in opposition to the government, but also sometimes maybe in conjunction with the government, and yet journalists continue to try to report on that material.
So much of what we know about media freedom comes from studying media in the United States and media in Western Europe. But we, being the Western world, is really advocating for media freedom in non-democratic settings and in countries that are developing, and we don't really know how it functions. And I would say that one of our biggest findings is that if you have media freedom in a non-democratic situation, it really puts journalists in a terrible position. I'm not advocating against media freedom, but what I'm saying is that it puts journalists at risk. And that's, I think, what we're seeing a lot of unfolding right now.
How interesting. So let's look at the relationship of media freedom to its effects, because these are some of the things that you guys have looked at in all of your work. So, for example, democratic peace, that's something, Doug Van Bell, you've explored. What's the relationship there?
Well, that's where this whole project originally started, way back in the 90s, looking at countries that go to war with one another. In political science and international relations, we had a great deal of difficulty explaining why democracies didn't seem to go to war with one another. And one of the findings of the press freedom work is that when you have two countries that have free presses, they not only don't go to war, they don't escalate to smaller lethal conflicts either. So you'll get two free press states going right up to the point where casualties are inflicted and then stopping and quickly de-escalating. And the reason is the nature of communication between the two countries is that in order to justify killing somebody in another country, you have to dehumanize them. The flow of information between two free press countries and the news media in both countries treating the people of the other country as the same as themselves prevents that from happening, and you get these instances where you get one or two casualties in a conflict between two free media countries, and it's just devastating for the leadership of the country because the public reacts very, very negatively to that.
It's interesting because you're saying it takes two media-free countries, but if we look at the United States history, it certainly is engaged in a lot of conflicts with not necessarily free media countries, but non-free media countries. Iraq would be the perfect example. There certainly was a lot of dehumanization in the U.S. side, right?
Yeah, and it's because the information coming from the non-free press country is treated like either as if it's propaganda or as if it's unreliable or in some other way that makes it seem less valid. And in that situation, the leader in the democratic country can basically create any image they want of the other side, because everything coming from the other side has to be in some way confirmed as reasonable. And all you have to do is then fight that confirmation. And it's pretty easy to do.
So Jennifer, you've also looked at media effects, media freedom effects, and you looked at, for example, intolerance, civil conflict. Is there a relationship there?
Well, what I found in some work that I've done with Mark Hutchison, co-author, is that media freedom combined with a high level of intolerance in a society is actually associated with increased civil conflict. Actually makes sense. I mean, if you think about it, because if you have a high level of social intolerance and you have media, news media being commercially dependent on getting the largest audience that they can get, the news media are going to cater to the social intolerance. And case that we looked at, we did a statistical analysis looking across countries and found that there was a significant effect. And then we looked specifically at the conflict in India, Gujarat, where there was some very interesting local media coverage that really seemed to inflame the conflict there between the Muslims and the Hindus.
So then I suppose the historic narratives, the culture, the institutions all together all would play a role there, right?
Absolutely. And just that if media are free and independent, they're going to cater to their audience most likely. And because all news organizations need an audience in order to continue and survive, whether they're dependent financially on that or they want to be heard. That's the whole point. And so in order to get that audience, they're going to cater to that audience. And if you have an intolerant audience, you're going to have the potential for media to really magnify that intolerance.
And so you could end up with a vicious circle situation where in order to get audience, media focus on this like blame and dehumanization of whoever they deem as the others or the bad guys, and then that could facilitate growing intolerant environments.
I think so. And I think if you think about this idea of echo chambers, because now in today's world we have so many sources that we can go to for our news and information and our entertainment. And people are inclined to seek out sources that are in sync with their viewpoints. And I think you can have echo chambers form around all different kinds of ideologies. And I think that that's something that we're seeing. So, for example, here you read about something in a newspaper or online, that in a blog, that really sort of fits with your point of view. And then you hear it on the radio or you see it on television. And it's just you're hearing so much your point of view that you're not hearing other points of view. And it really reinforces your own intolerance.
One of the other things that you also mentioned in the book is about the responsibilities that come with media freedoms. In other words, media freedom does not mean you have a freedom to spread hate, for example. But how does this fit in with all the research that you have been doing?
Absolutely. Doug and I have found that free news media are not guaranteed to be responsible news media. If you look at what happened in Uganda, where you have a non-democratic setting, a highly intolerant society as far as it comes to homosexuality, and you have news organizations that are incredibly irresponsible. So you had this tabloid, there were actually several tabloids, but the one that was the first to do, or the first to get noticed for doing so, was this tabloid called The Rolling Stone, no affiliation with the magazine in the United States. But The Rolling Stone published pictures of people that The Rolling Stone said were gay and had just this terrible message saying, hang them, a banner, hang them. And a guy who was featured on the front page of that edition actually was eventually killed.
Wow. That wouldn't be the first place that something like that had happened, right? So certainly
no.
We've all examined some of the things that happened in, say, Rwanda or the former Yugoslavia, similar kinds of, you know, media messages and then the echo chamber like you described. So then the question becomes, where is the line between media freedom and media responsibility? Doug Van Bell, would you have a sense about that from all the studies you've done?
There's two things to think about, and that is, one, when we talk about media freedom, we're talking about that right to complain and criticize. So that's sort of different than no rules for the media. So something such as the fairness doctrine that the U.S. used to have, which, well, I would argue is the big problem with U.S. media freedom at the moment, is that it's no longer there. That's perfectly compatible with the nature of media freedom. Limitations on hate speech are perfectly compatible with this idea that you can criticize government and powerful officials. So if you go to different countries around the world, you have different ways of trying to maintain that ability to criticize, to create that feedback into government from the public, while still keeping that responsibility for sort of civilized behavior. So here in New Zealand, we have a far different set of laws around media freedom and such. And even though it's more restrictive here in what you can report, most would argue that it works better here than it does in the United States at the moment. And so you can similarly see these things around the world in terms of liability laws, libel laws, safe speech laws, hate speech laws. Those are all compatible with media freedom and are a way of embodying the responsibility aspect as long as they don't limit that ability to criticize government.
Jennifer, anything you'd want to add to that?
Just that the problem with pushing for media to be responsible is that it can very quickly cross into a push to control media. For example, Kagame in Rwanda, the current leader of Rwanda, has used Rwanda's history with the radio stations being used to mobilize people in the genocide there. He's used that history to make a claim that, well, we can't have media freedom in Rwanda right now, and that it needs to be controlled because of the danger there.
The fear of the civil conflict and intolerance.
Right, right. So I think that it's a bit of a slippery slope. Anti-hate speech laws are probably the best option that we have for helping to strike that balance. But then when you get into saying, you know, well, what's responsible, what's irresponsible, who gets to say what's responsible and what's irresponsible? Do you require journalists to be licensed? Well, who gets to decide who gets a license and who doesn't? It very quickly gets very complicated. So leaders don't like being criticized. In a lot of countries, we see criticism of the leaders or the ruling family criminalized, and that's a form of control. Mm-hmm. So trying to get media to be responsible can very quickly get turned into a form of media control beyond control aimed at keeping media responsible. So it is difficult.
Yeah, it's one of those little fine lines that can get moved into the wrong direction, I suppose. You know, one of the other things that I always think about when I think about media freedom is that we always contextualize it in terms of criticizing the government, the right to complain about government. But, you know, it seems like there is also another form of constraint on media, and that is this sort of constraint to make a corporate profit, which also kind of ties the hands of journalists in terms of doing certain kinds of exposés or covering certain kinds of stories that, you know, might be critical of a particular business or economic system or something like that. Has that ever been something that has come on your radar?
It does come on the radar. Generally, what you find is, if you look into it, it's rare that a situation like that reaches the point where it actually threatens media freedom. You have several instances where it's problematic in an individual case or in regards to an individual corporation and that sort of thing. But if you have enough media outlets in a state or a nation, generally what you will find is that if that information is there, someone will bring it out. And so what we look at is there a way for those, you know, corporations to stop it from coming out at all? That's really going to be the real danger sign, is if a corporation can shut down a critical area of coverage. If they can shut it down entirely through legal means, for instance, through use of libel law and that sort of thing, that is a big danger sign in terms of media freedom.
I suppose I ask that partly for two reasons. One of the journalists I had interviewed was in Russia, and he said that in Russia, their big concern is less about government repression and more about these corporations that own the media and also are affiliated with particular politicians or political parties. And so it's ownership structure that prevents them. It's self-censorship rather than, you know, it's their job, not their, that they're necessarily going to go to jail.
Yeah, the news media in Russia isn't anywhere near free. There was some hints that it might have gone that direction. But what you're talking about is sort of what's often called a captured news media. And you see these in, for instance, you used to see that in Spain, where there was no official censorship, but under Franco, all of the media outlets were owned by the government's friends and therefore were indirectly controlled through those economic relationships. You saw it in Latin America in the 1970s through the control of paper for the printing presses. Basically, the government didn't control the news media. They controlled whether or not the news media could have paper to print on. So those are the sorts of things you see. It's when that eliminates the ability to cover by all of the news media, that's when it really becomes problematic. It's something to be watchful for and to be alert for as sort of a maintenance level in your own, you know, media free media countries. But it's not that often that it rises to the point where it threatens media freedom.
Jennifer Witten Woodring?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why it isn't as much of a problem as we might assume that it would be is that news organizations depend on credibility. And if you fail to cover a story that's important in today's world, it's probably going to be covered by another news organization. And then you're not going to look very credible, and people aren't going to want to tune into you. So there's this fear of losing credibility that in some cases, I think, really helps to keep news media at least honest. And you may have a news organization that will not initially cover a story, but if it's being covered by, you know, not being covered by mainstream media, but gets picked up by what we would characterize as more fringe special interest media, eventually it's going to reach a level where the mainstream media can't ignore it or they're going to lose credibility. So I think that is one of the factors that keeps that from becoming as much of a problem in a free media environment as you might think. But, you know, there's certainly there are a lot of ways that media are controlled in non-free environments where there's a lot of self-censorship on the part of journalists, because they know that if they report critically, they're going to pay a high cost, maybe even their own lives.
Exactly. So maybe that's the distinction that we really are drawing when we're talking about true media freedom is, are you going to pay for this with your life? Not necessarily your job, but your life, like imprisonment, death, that kind of a thing. So I wonder also if we could take a look at all the countries that you evaluated. And first, kind of one of the things you did was break them into geographic regions. What were the patterns that you saw in terms of media freedom in these geographic regions? Jennifer Witten Woodring?
One of the most interesting patterns that I noticed was in Africa. So as countries gained independence from their colonizers, initially there would be this period of media freedom, or it would look like media were going to be operating in a free manner. And then, you know, in the power vacuum created by independence, the leadership would become more and more authoritarian, and that media independence in many cases would just go away. And then, you know, after years and years of struggle, we see some of these countries emerging with free media systems. But so you'll see an initial period of media freedom followed by a big shutdown of media freedom. That was one of the patterns I noticed in Africa.
Doug Van Bell, any pattern that you'd like to bring out?
There was and we haven't looked in the new data for this pattern, but we found a pattern in the overall, in the first cut of the data that went through the mid-90s, and that was when you had a U.S. president that attacked the media at home, you found that the media, the press freedom abroad also declined. And one of the things you would see was that when a U.S. president, such as Richard Nixon in the 70s, attacked the news media in the U.S., countries overseas, you would have dictators then turn around and copy that and attack their own news media, whether it's they felt free from the U.S. pressure to be free, you know, to be democratic, or whether they just simply copied that policy action or not, but it was a pretty striking pattern that we saw, that news media steadily increases over the years. It's been a steady, steady increase. And then you get these setbacks, and these setbacks always occur right after you have a U.S. president going in and criticizing and attacking the media in one way or another.
That's fascinating, actually. You know, I guess we can't really let you go unless we do sort of a typical media thing and say, all right, well, who's the worst and who's the best in terms of media freedom? What was the least free country or countries that you found? Jennifer Witten Woodring?
Well, that's hard because there's a lot of competition in that category. I mean, obviously, North Korea would be one. Doug, did you want to add to that?
No, North Korea is the hands-down obvious answer. You get a lot of dictators around the world, but nobody does crazy media control like those guys up in North Korea. It's insane to the point where it's just astounding.
And then in terms of the most free, who would you say? What would you say?
Not the
U.S. I would actually argue that there isn't a most free. I would actually argue that once you get a functional free press, The variations tend to become variations of form rather than actual freedom. So as long as you're not in that situation where you've actually got threats to freedom and the ability to criticize, you get variations in form rather than variations in levels of freedom. So if you look at, for instance, the Nordic countries, they always rank very, very high on people's measures of freedom. But they have very strict controls over what counts as news, news organizations, funding systems for news and that sort of thing. Whereas you get the United States, where in terms of sort of freedom in a sort of intellectual sense, in terms of anything goes, you have that going in the United States. You can literally report anything you want and call it news. Which you can't do in most other free press countries. Many argue that the United States is nowhere near as good a free press country as someplace like Britain or New Zealand, where they have controls on you have to be truthful and those sorts of things.
Jennifer Witten Woodring, last word.
I get the last word? Oh, my goodness. Well, I think that what we found in writing the book was that media freedom isn't always where you would expect it to be. So it does exist in countries that are really lacking in other democratic characteristics. And similarly, there are democracies that have a surprising amount of control exerted over media. So I think if we left you with anything, that would be it.
Well, thank you so much, Jennifer Witten Woodring and Douglas Van Bell, for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. It's really fascinating.
Thank you for having us.
That was Jennifer Witten Woodring, professor at University of Massachusetts at Lowell, and Douglas Van Bell, senior lecturer at Victoria University. And their book is called The Historical Guide to World Media Freedom. When we come back, what dictators, CEOs, and other political leaders have in common. We'll explore some of their strategies for getting and keeping power. Stay tuned.
Everybody knows that the plague is coming. Everybody knows that it's moving fast. Everybody knows that the naked man and woman are just a shining artifact of the past. Everybody knows the scene is dead, but there's gonna be a meter on your bed that will disclose what everybody knows. Everybody knows that you're in trouble. Everybody knows what you've been through. From the bloody cross on top of Calvary.
Hey, Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Is there a universal formula for getting and keeping power? Our next guest says there is, and it often involves what he calls bad behavior. Alistair Smith is professor of politics at NYU, New York University, and the co-author of The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. Welcome, Alistair Smith.
I'm glad I could be with you.
You start by examining the city of Bell. Remind us of what happened in Bell and how this plays into your argument about bad behavior being good politics.
We regard all leaders, whether they're of corporations, sports federations, dictatorships, or democracy, as all having some basic desire, and that's sustained power. And this would be exactly the same with the leaders in Bell. And this was, I'm sure this hit the news in L.A., and it even made it over to New York in terms of the newspaper, that the leadership there, the Rizzo, had set up this beautiful system where he got paid around, I think it was $700,000 salary. So he was massively more paid than virtually every other elected public official in the country. And he managed to do this because he engineered a system where he could be beholden to very few people to stay in power.
You're talking about the city manager.
Absolutely. And this is the goal that all leaders, this is one of the sort of five basic principles that leaders want to have coming to power, is they want to be beholden to very small numbers of people. They don't want to rely on many people to stay in power. And so he organized this very tiny sort of election to switch the charter of the city so it wasn't governed by the rest of the city, state of California. And this small rule change, which was a sort of an innocuous, boring, bureaucratic rule, so very few people turned up, meant that with a few hundred votes, he could actually assemble a city council that would vote through all the reforms he wanted. So his salary went up from, I think, around $150,000 to 10 years later being $700,000 plus. So he managed to do this because he could rely on very few people. And then the people on the town council that got elected with these very small numbers of voters, several hundred voters were all he needed really to keep most of these people in, they managed to vote themselves enormous salaries via special enterprise zones and special committees. That's how they got rich.
You talked about how the city then charged some 50% more for property taxes, and they just engineered this entire system of politics that resembles often what you say are dictatorship politics.
Absolutely. So one of the other fundamental rules you want to do is tax as heavily as you possibly can. Tax as heavily as the economy will bear, and the people and your supporters will pay. Well, you know, Rizzo's now got this system where he's not actually beholden to very many people. Not many people pay attention to this small-scale town politics, changing the rules and such like. And most of the council members don't require that many votes, several hundred votes, to become a member of this committee. And so what they did was they taxed very heavily, much higher taxes than richer, wealthier neighbors that surrounded them. They brought all this money in, and they distributed it out to themselves and to favored people, but they didn't generate good public policy for the people. These are the rules. You want to reward those who are keeping you in power.
Why a small group to be beholden to? Why is that helping to keep certain people in power?
Leaders always, the best way to survive as a political leader is to reduce the number of people you need to stay in power. So this would be disenfranchising people in the electoral system is a perfect way to stay in power. That way you need the support of fewer people. So in the U.S., we see the Electoral College. That means the president only needs to win about 35 million votes to win the presidency. You typically get much more than that, but you don't need to win as many because you don't have to win half the support of half of the voters, which is what we typically think, but that's not what you need to do to actually win. So all leaders want to change the rules to get the group as small as possible. And the great thing is, if you don't have many people to reward, you can give each of them, and just think of it in a very simple way. You have a pot of money. You don't have many people. They can each have a very large, each person's share of the pot of money is very large. That doesn't work once you get up into huge numbers because each person's share becomes very small. And so leaders, when they're beholden to a lot of people, they have to start producing good public policy, which is much harder to do. And it's easier for rivals to claim they can do a better job.
Now, one of the things that struck me in this book, it's actually in the very first chapter, you talk about politics not being complex, but then you say leaders are not monolithic, and it's silly to think that they are in control of their jurisdictions, whether they're countries or companies. And you take a look back at old France. What can we learn from old France, and how does this all come together?
Well, this is the great thing. So we tend to think of, you know, these regimes, we call them absolute monarchs when we think of sort of Louis XIV. He's an absolute monarch. You know, everything he said was law. Well, everything he said was law because the people that were enforcing the system agreed with him everything that he said being law because he was paying them a lot. So no leader stays in power by themselves. So whether we want to think of it as a corporation, or we want to think of it as a sports federation, or we want to think of it as a democracy, you have to have supporters to keep you in there to make the rules. So everybody relies upon keeping these supporters happy. So that's the simple objective of political leaders, is to keep these people happy to stay in power. The difference between all the different how the different systems function is the number of people that you have to keep happy.
And you talk about these three groups of peoples. You call them dimensions. Mm-hmm. You say they're consistent across governments, whether democracies or dictatorships. Explain these three groups of people, the nominal, real, selectorate, and the winning coalition, and how do we see them in both dictatorships and in democracies?
Yep. So when we tend to think about political organizations, we tend to think democracy and non-democracy, or a junta, or a dictatorship. But what we don't realize is that there's enormous variation within those categories. So we want to, instead of thinking about that all democracies are the same and all autocracies are the same and all hunters are the same, we want to think about them on a continuum of scales. So the simplest scale is the winning coalition. How many supporters does a leader need? So we can think, we've done some expert surveys asking sort of country experts, how many people does this leader really need? So it could be from a few hundred in some of the most autocratic systems like North Korea up to 35 million people in the United States to be president. So that can vary enormously. Then we want to think about, who really has some say. So in a democracy, that tends to be all adults. Or all adult citizens, I should say. So in the U.S., there's about 160 million registered voters. So that's the selectorate, and that's the people who get the choice. In other systems, it could be much lower. If we were in a monarchy, then we'd only be really worrying about aristocrats. If we were in a junta, we'd be worrying about the senior generals. So we want to worry about how many people we have to pick to be supporters and how big a pool can we draw supporters from.
So what you're saying is the broader the selectorate, the more likely you'll have a system that is more democratic in nature and more perhaps egalitarian?
This is a classic mistake we want to think of. So you use the term selectorate there. So this is the pool of people who have some nominal say. So this would be an electorate. And in the U.S. system where we have fixed electoral rules, you're absolutely right that the more people we bring into the electorate, the more the coalition of supporters of political leader needs because we actually obey the electoral rules. But actually, this is one of the points we make in the book is that rigged elections are sort of a terrible thing for the people. So in those kind of systems, what we do is we allow everyone to vote, but the votes really don't count. We know that that's not really the important point. It actually depends upon not who votes, but who counts. And it turns out the counters are the important people in an electoral system, in a corrupt electoral system. And one of the beautiful things about, and it's exactly the opposite to what you just said, is by making the electorate larger, we make the society more equal. We do exactly the opposite. What we do is we make the leader could still be beholden to a small number of people, but the corrupt electoral system allows the leader to find lots and lots of replacements. There's nothing special about people in positions of power in a democracy. They can be replaced by anybody. You can always rig another election to get somebody out of the parliament and bring back another crony. So it's not the electorate we should worry about. It's how many people matter.
You wrote about once these coalitions are put together by leaders in order to put them in power, that it often changes once they reach power. You use the example of Fidel Castro. What happened with Fidel Castro?
This is a classic case that all leaders face. Is when you come to power, you need the people who are in positions of authority now, for example, people in control of the army, people in charge of the police, to support you coming to power, or voters of the current regime in a democracy to turn against the incumbent to bring you to power. So you're very constrained in who you can choose when you try to come to power. When you put your coalition of supporters together, you've got to, in some sense, include some of the old guys, because you needed them to come to you so that you could kick the incumbent out. But once you get there, you've got the problem that, well, these people have already demonstrated they're not very loyal. They just helped you bring down the previous guy. So you should sit there and think, I would like to get my cronies in, people who are really loyal to me, people who only have a standing in society because of me, who won't be good rivals. And so then what leaders like to do is try and weed out the people they suspect of being disloyal and replace them with people that they think will be loyal over the long term. And so we see lots of culling of people when they come in. So we can think of some other classic examples. So as you pointed out, Castro, he wiped out most of the cronies that fought alongside him in, you know, the rebel movements. Very usual. People fighting, comrade in arms, they get into power. One guy comes in charge, all the other guys suddenly become traitors. Very familiar story. You could think of Adolf Hitler had, you know, the famous sort of Night of the Long Knives. The black shirts turned up and the SS turned up and took away all the brown shirts, his previous sort of paramilitary organization. Complete sort of culling overnight happened.
Do you see that much in democratic settings?
Well, we do. We don't see the violence. George W. Bush came to power, you know, with Christian conservatives. You don't see him, you know, dropping factions of the you don't see, you know, factions that he's no longer supporting their positions. We don't see them being knifed. But we do see that politicians come to power and they will move their support base. So they won't adopt, so they come to power promising to do X, Y, and Z, and maybe they do X and Y. They don't do Z. So some of the people are going to want to move from them, and at the same time, they'll be trying to attract supporters they think are going to be more likely to support them if they give them their policies. So we see this politicians, as we all know, never completely honest about what they're going to do. Once they get in, they'll shift who they support.
So in essence, you say these rulers come into power with coalitions, then they shake them up, replace them, then allocate money to keep their new coalition happy, but not too happy, and then give enough to the rest to keep them from revolting.
That's right. You've been reading the book very carefully. You sort of summarized the rules, right? You want to get in a small number of people as possible from a big pool. You want to tax very heavily, which is sort of the one thing we haven't talked a huge amount about. Then you pay off the coalition. And then make sure you keep some money for yourself. Don't be too nice to the people. That's exactly what all good leaders who want to keep their job should do. And leaders get into trouble when they fail to follow these rules.
It's very Machiavellian, no?
Absolutely. And, you know, we've been accused of being very cynical. But cynical doesn't mean wrong. Cynical just means we believe it's both cynical and extremely accurate way to describe how politics works. And it is a cynical Machiavellian approach, but, you know, we spend a large portion of the end of the book developing ideas. We tell you how the system works. So this is how you fix it. You can't fix a system unless you understand how it works. You don't take your car to a mechanic if the mechanic has no idea how a car runs. They can't make your car work better if they don't understand how it works. So we spend a lot of time developing these rules and explaining how the system works, and then we tell you how you're going to fix the system.
You say leaders support those who support them or who will keep them in power, but couldn't it be the reverse? That their concern for a certain ideology dictates the bloc.
We don't deny that ideology and culture, that they exist, but we just think they're very convenient labels. So we can identify by these labels who's going to be rewarded and who's going to be punished. So if we want to think about, for example, in the US, we got the jobs bill. We can think of this as sort of a big ideological thing. Is it class warfare? Do we want to tax? Do we want tax and spend? Do we want to let free markets reign? We can think of a lot of ideological labels being used in this debate. But what it really comes down to is these labels are telling us who's going to win. Who's going to profit under the scheme if a leader comes in, and who's going to suffer? So let's take the extreme here. We've got, let's cut taxes. Well, who would benefit if we're going to cut taxes? Rich people are going to benefit if we cut taxes. Well, who tends to be rich? Republicans tend to be rich. They're going to like these policies. If we think about job creation, Obama keeps talking about, you know, he wants money for teachers and public service employees and construction workers. Well, who's going to benefit from those? Well, unions, teachers, construction workers tend to be Democrats. So he's basically talking about transferring. So we may think of these as ideology, but we're really just identifying groups that are going to be rewarded under different sets of policies.
It could be that they actually believe in these policies, and so do those other people. Perhaps people on one side really want to stay in power in order to make sure the system is more egalitarian.
This is always, of course, we don't get the opportunity to see people act outside of this chicken or egg thing. So we have to look for a few examples of where people switch policies. So let me give you two. Let me give you an example, an American example, and then I'll move to a more extreme example. So think of a famous American politician, Strom Thurmond. So Strom Thurmond was a huge segregationist. He took positions that were highly racist right up until the Civil Rights Acts came through, and suddenly he found out he had a constituency that was full of blacks. What did he do as soon as he had that? He completely switched the sets of policies he wanted. He went from this group should be disadvantaged to, oh, I have to rely upon a lot of this group now. I'm going to switch my policies. So here's a politician who knew what he needed to do and what he needed to do to stay in power shifted, so he changed policies. I can give you an even more extreme example, which is actually one of the few cases Bruce and I identified as a leader, an individual who's ruled two countries at the same time. Lots of people do it like you're the queen of one country and therefore you're, you know, a ruler of an empire, but as actually two independent countries. So King Leopold of Belgium also ruled the Congo, but he ruled that as he set this up as a private company that went over and captured the Congo for himself. So when he was back at home, he believed in liberal ideas, unions, promoting working standards and healthcare for an education for the people. And in the Congo, he was a brutal killer of anyone who resisted him in any way that stopped him making money on rubber. So we have to ask ourselves, leaders are doing what gets them in power and wealth. They're not adopting the same ideological conditions under two different circumstances.
Is this really applicable in the general sense, or are you taking a single individual and trying to say that all leaders are like him because he's the one example we have where you see a double ideology?
No, I think that's not that. We see changes at all. So one of the descriptions we spend a lot of time talking about was a classic reformer, which was Jerry Rawlings in Ghana. So we spend a lot of time talking about JJ, he was known as, Junior Jesus. He was a bit of a charismatic character in Ghana. Instituted a socialist revolution when he first came into power and wanted to pay the army and promote socialist ideas and damp out opposition to himself. This was right up until he ran out of money. And then we see him radically changing his policies, liberalizing, and he actually became the sort of poster boy for IMF reforms and then liberalizing democracy. But he didn't do this because he wanted to. He did this because he had to.
Is it that particular kinds of people pursue leadership?
We often get asked this. So people ask us, do you believe that all leaders are sort of nasty and brutish and self-interested? And the answer to that question is, well, first I scratched my head. I was like, all the words made sense, but put together, of course, they do. Yeah, what else could you possibly think? Is it possible that there are people who are less self-interested around the world? I suspect that that might be true. We could vary on that degree. But the point is, those kind of people are not going to run for political office. So we might ask ourselves, political leaders, seizing power in a democracy involves taking hideously violent acts and brutal suppression of opposition and often killing people. People who aren't interested in coming to power and paying those costs aren't the kind of people who become leadership roles. We shouldn't worry. So within the set of leaders, I think it's incredibly clear that they're all self-interested louts.
So it is the kind of person that finds himself or herself pursuing a position of leadership.
I tend to think, not everybody wants to be the leader of a country. I personally think it would be, being a leader would be a horrible job. But the set of people that do, there's a lot of people want to pursue power. There is no shortage of claimants to the throne, shall we say.
Is it possible for benevolent types, altruistic or symbiotic types, to be able to reach and keep leadership if, in fact, you are right about the process it takes to get into power and stay in power?
So you're maybe thinking, we have our Plato philosopher kings. Wouldn't this be perfect? Our benevolent dictator, he could just do the right thing.
I'm thinking not necessarily benevolent dictator. I'm thinking Jimmy Carter. Obviously, he didn't stay in office. So he pursued power, but he didn't keep power. Could we have people who are actually truly concerned about the plight of people?
I think you can, but they can't always act upon that all the time. So the first thing is, even if you want to really help the people, you can't help the people unless you stay in power. So the first and foremost job you have to do, even if you want to, in some sense, spend all the discretion you have on helping the people, is stay in power. And staying in power relies on keeping your cronies happy. So in a democracy, that actually generally means doing things that are good for the public good, because you have to keep so many people happy in the first place. You may as well work towards the public good in some sense. In an autocracy, it's very hard to spend money helping the people if that takes money out the pocket of your cronies. So we could think of a classic example would be Julius Caesar, right? There's a lot of confusion about him. Everybody thinks he's this guy who wants to be king in Rome. The reality is he went around reforming the roads, laying out the city, getting the water working, organizing the calendar, tons of things. But he made a big mistake, was he also started canceling debts of the common people to promote the economy. Well, of course, he relied upon members of the Senate and powerful rich people who were owned this debt. They were very unhappy about this, and so they stabbed him down. So you can only be good if it comes out of your pocket, not out of your crony's pocket.
You know, you reminded me of this section of your book about infrastructure and education, and I was struck by the leader, the African leader, who said to the Rwandan president, don't build roads, because then those are more roads they can come and get you with. And the only roads to develop are the ones that help you get out when you need to.
Absolutely. And he was quite ruthless in his pursuit of power and maintenance of power. He didn't give a damn about the people of Zaire. They lived miserable, miserable lives. Let me give you another example, rather than just the roads, which he did. He inherited like 70,000 miles of roads, and when he left, you know, several decades later, it was only like 6,000 miles of roads left. He got rid of them, just let them decompose. But he actually decided he was going to run his copper mines that were down in the south of the country with hydroelectric power stations from the river right near where he controlled in the north. So he ran a power line, basically close to 1,000 miles across the country. And he actually went out of his way to bypass all the cities and towns on the way so that no one would have electrification. But he maintained the key thing was that since he then controlled the power supply, he could turn off the copper production. If anyone else tried to steal it and seize control and get the wealth from the copper mines, he could control that copper mine. So he was focusing on bringing the wealth to him.
And similar with education.
Absolutely. Want to educate people. If you're an autocrat, you want to educate people to the extent that they can do the jobs you need them to do. And so educating them more than that, giving people an advanced education, people learn how to organize against you. And we saw that leaders in Egypt, for example, got in trouble because they had a large number of educated and underemployed people who could organize protests against them. If you keep the people poor and ignorant and separated, very, very hard for them to organize against you.
Let's talk for a moment about the corporation, because you say these apply also to corporations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And specifically with the same kinds of rules, but then also how corruption really helps. How does it help these leaders?
Well, so the reality is we think of the classic economic model is the company is out there maximizing profit. They're not maximizing profit. They're not helping companies. Leaders want to stay at the top of their corporations, and so they have to keep the support of people. So who are the supporters in a publicly traded company? We'd like to think it's the shareholders, but you and I are all own some kind of share, and occasionally we get those proxy forms through the mailbox, right? And what's the first thing we do with that? We look and I don't understand what this is, and we throw it away. So most of the time we have a nominal say, we have a vote, but our votes don't matter. Control of publicly traded corporation comes down to the board, a few senior management, and a few big institutional investors. So that's typically tens of people. It's rarely more than tens of people. And yet these can be huge multi-billion dollar organizations.
When we look at a system where there is considerable corruption, you say that if we do things like increase sentencing, look at legislative fixes, they're counterproductive in part because they give leverage to the powerful. Why do you say that?
Well, you know, let's stay on the sort of business environment now. We just sort of said, you know, corporations are run with a relatively small group of supporters, and we want to know why people are on occupying Wall Street screaming about why Wall Street is so tone deaf to the plight of the people. It's because the leader's beholden to this small number of people, and how should they be rewarding them with big bloated consultancies and big private fees for running corporations, and executive salaries should be huge. So we get this kind of corruption. And so what we're seeing is we expect to see these big salaries. So, you know, the call at the moment for reform is let's outlaw these large salaries and everything. And this is a terrible thing to do because this is the basis of corruption. Would we sooner see things paid illegally rather than legally? If the basis of political power is rewarding a small number of people, it's always going to be involving large amounts of transfers of cash. So, you know, we see this in the Olympic Committee. We see huge bribes being paid for votes to locate the Olympics in a particular city. So outlawing things, ignoring the underlying political incentive, is always the wrong way to go. And I think you're pointing to the section of the book where we say, if you make a law against sort of taking bribes and bad behavior, all you really do is empower the person who gave out the bribe, but they now have evidence to keep people in line even more.
And so you say the incentive system itself should perhaps be changed.
Absolutely. There's no point changing a rule. So, you know, if you take a salary above $10 million, you've broken the law. Because then people are going to start trying to reward supporters through the back door, so long as leaders are beholden to a small number of people. So what you want to do is you've got to change the actual governance structure. So if we go to the sort of the Olympic Bribe Committee, which is something many people are familiar with, the Salt Lake City bribery, every year there's huge amounts of bribery, and I'm a huge soccer fan. FIFA's full of bribery about where they're going to locate the World Cup of soccer. Every year But the reason is there's lots of bribery because so few people are involved in making that decision. All we have to do is to make those decisions get made better and outlaw corruption is simply have the decision depend upon more people.
How would that apply in governance?
In a corporation, we want to...
I meant in political governance.
Political governments, well, we want to make the President of the United States more accountable to the people. We should get rid of the Electoral College. The president would overnight have to appeal to twice the number of people he currently has to appeal to. So at the moment, you need to win half the seats in, you know, sort of half the states. Win even less because some states are overrepresented in the Electoral College. So half the seats, so that's in half the you need half the votes in half the states, so that's 25% of the vote. If you had got rid of the Electoral College, all of a sudden you need 50% of the vote. So instantly you make the president work much harder. He's got to keep twice as many people happy as he was before. In Congress, you get the same thing, gerrymandering. So many districts are so highly gerrymandered where the politicians pick their voters rather than the voters pick their leader that you can control Congress. Very few of the seats are competitive.
Alistair Smith, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. The name of the book is The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. Thank you so much.
That'd be my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody.